Canto 3, Chapter 10, Divisions of the Creation, Text 12. Vishvam vai Brahmatan Matram.
Vishvam vai Brahmatan Matram.
Samstitam Vishnumayaya.
Samstitam Vishnumayaya.
Ishvarena Parishchinam.
Ishvarena Parishchinam.
Kalina Vyakta Murtina.
Kalina Vyakta Murtina.
Vishvam.
Vishvam.
The material phenomenon. By certainly, Brahma, the Supreme, Tat Matram, the same as, Samstitam, situated,
Vishnu
Mayaya,
by
the energy of Vishnu,
Ishwarena,
by the personality of Godhead.
Parichinam,
separated.
Kalina,
by the eternal time.
Avyakta,
unmanifested.
Murtina,
by such a feature. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. This cosmic manifestation is separated from the Supreme Lord as material energy by means of Kala, which is the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Lord. It is situated as the objective manifestation of the Lord under the influence of the same material energy of Vishnu. Please repeat, this cosmic manifestation
is
separated from the Supreme Lord
as material energy
by means of Kala, which is the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Lord. It is situated as the objective manifestation
of the Lord,
under the influence
of
the same material energy of Vishnu. Purport. As stated previously by Narada before Vyasadeva, 1.5.20, Idam hi Vishvam Bhagavan Ivetara. This unmanifested world is the self-same personality of Godhead, but it appears to be something else beyond or besides the Lord. It appears so because of its being separated from the Lord by the means of Kala. It is something like the tape-recorded voice of a person who is now separated from the voice. As the tape recording is situated on the tape, so the whole cosmic manifestation is situated on the material energy and appears to be separate by means of Kala. The material manifestation is therefore the objective manifestation of the Supreme Lord and exhibits His impersonal feature so much adored by the impersonalist philosophers. In other words, the impersonalists are in Maya. Yeah? Because they adore that feature, the impersonal feature, but that impersonal feature is simply time. And time regulates the material energy, not the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, of course, there's only Krishna's presence, and therefore there is no time as we understand it. Yeah, it's mentioned in the Brahma Samhita that it's not marked by the passing of even half a moment. There's no past, there's no future, but there's simply presence. That is the feature of time. That is Krishna. And in the material world, everything is regulated by this impersonal feature of Krishna. You know, we talk about the regulative principles. So this is the one regulative principle that nobody can avoid, time. Yeah. In due course of time, everything will be exposed. Everything will be shown. So nobody can do anything without it being exposed by time. Sometimes people think that they can hide something, or by forgetfulness, then it doesn't exist anymore. There's a story that Prabhupada used to tell about one of his professors at Scottish Church's College. who used to try to argue against the idea that the Hindus have of karma. That why should a person be punished for something that he can't even remember doing? Yeah? If you take another birth, you don't remember what you've done in the past. And the idea that you should be punished or, you know, receive some kind of retribution or effect from something that you may have done in a past life is unjust, because you can't remember it. Yeah. This argument they would sometimes use, because they're all Christians, and they have a linear conception. Yeah. That means that they think that everything is unique. Trudhikarma Prabhu explains this very nicely in his paper that he wrote in 1994, Puranic Time and Archaeology, and the Archaeological Record. Because that idea that everything progresses from one point to another in a straight line, from a beginning point to an end point, yeah, that's linear. That's not actually, it's a kind of a Judeo-Christian concept. Yeah, it's just all in a straight line. It has a beginning and an end and a bit in the middle, and so you get one life, you progress through that life, you come to the end of it, there's an end judgment, you know, there's kind of a final cataclysmic event that finishes everything, both microcosmically and macrocosmically. Yeah, that the universe begins at a certain point and it ends at a certain point, and then in the middle there's this kind of progress of the living beings. And therefore human beings in the theory of evolution are considered to be, you know, the latest manifestation of evolution. So they got that idea actually from the Judeo-Christian concept. They just removed God out of the picture, but they kept with the same basic structure, the evolutionist. That there's a beginning point, there's a progression, and there's an end point. But in the Vedic concept, and actually even in other previous civilizations like the Greeks, they also believed in a cyclic concept of time. Yeah? What goes around comes around. I think you start here, you go around, and you end up back where you started. And that goes on and on and on. It never stops. Even the manifestation of the universes is cyclic. Vishnu breathes out, the universes appear, he breathes in, they go back in, he breathes out, they come back out, he breathes in, they go back in, and it's always going on, perpetually. So this is the Vedic concept, cyclic. And if we look at the way that we measure time, because you can't measure time, but you can observe the effects of time, by movement. This will be explained more clearly in the coming verses in the next chapter, that the only way you can understand time is by movement of the atom. One small atom, but then a mass of atoms. And by the movement through space, you can understand the influence of time. But it's measured differently according to the mass. Yeah? If you have one tiny little atom, or if you have a, you know, big conglomerate of atoms like a planet, then you measure the movement differently. That's how you understand the influence of time on that object. So you get an atom, you know, what is its movement? It's so minute you can't see it. Nobody can see an atom. So in that sense then, the atom is the closest representation of time in the universe, because you can't see it. Yeah, it's so tiny and small. But then you have, you know, the big planets, sun planet, moon planet, earth planet, all the living beings that are on it, in other masses of atoms, big and small. And each one of them marks time according to their own mass, their bodily mass. Yeah. So like the demigods, we say they live, you know, 10,000 celestial years. That's according to their bodily situation, the planet that they're situated on, and the way that it's moving in the universe through space. Even on this planet, if you live on the North Pole, you get 6 months of day and 6 months of night. Yeah. We like to measure time by looking at a watch. We've divided it up into hours, 24 hours in a day, and there's a certain period of light and a certain period of dark. We adjust our activities according to that movement. So when you're in the light period, do certain things. When you're in the dark period, you do other things. And your body's affected by that. Yeah. So similarly, the demigods, they have 6 months. Is our 6 months is their one day, and 6 months is their one night. If you live on the North Pole, you'll experience that. 6 months, 6 months. Doesn't make you a demigod, though. You become very cold, but that's another thing. But the idea is that time is not a fixed substance. Yeah, it's inconceivable because it's a feature of Krishna, and everything about Krishna is inconceivable. But you can understand its presence by its effect. Even in science, they accept that principle because they talk about dark energy and dark matter. Nobody's ever observed it. But they say it comprises of about 95% of the universe. But nobody's ever actually observed a substance, dark matter or dark energy. And that's why they say it's dark. Dark means unknown. Yeah, Krishna. The word Krishna means dark. So in this way, then they can't actually understand what it is in the universe, the substance of the universe, but they know something's there by its effect. And this is how they actually measure things. You can't see a black hole. That's why it's called a black hole, because it's so black you don't know what it is. But they see some effect, you know, in a certain area of the universe, and so they've given this name black hole. They actually don't know what's going on there, but by the effect that something's happening, there's some movement. If there was no movement, what would you understand? If nothing moved, trying to think of that. If nothing moved, everything would come to a standstill. There would be no time. So time enters or combined with the Mahat-Tattva produces movement. And when there's a question of movement, then there's the three modes of material nature. They mix together and they produce different effects upon the atoms in the universe. And then the other ingredient, of course, is the Jivatma, who is injected into the material universe. It's from the body of the Lord. And then by their entering into particular atomic situations, then they move by the influence of time. And so they go from one body to another, one planet to another, one activity to another, constantly. Always there is movement. Of course, living entities are active. That Krishna makes that point in the Bhagavad Gita very early on, that the living entity cannot be inactive even for a moment. What can repression accomplish? So that movement, that activity, is originally there in the spiritual world. Krishna is supremely active, ever expanding. All of his leelas are going on, and all of his devotees are active in their relationships with the Supreme Lord. If they become separated from Krishna and come into the material world, it's not that they lose their ability to be active, but the environment that they become active within is restricted. So they get entrapped by space and time. Yeah. These are the two major factors in the material world: space and time. And according to the space that you're allotted and that the time, the way that the time works upon the mass of atoms that you've acquired, yeah, then you get, you know, what we call a lifetime. The lifetime of an ant, the lifetime, you know, of some insects, they only live by our calculation just a few hours. Yeah, and they do everything within those few hours. Yeah, they take birth, they grow up, they eat, sleep, mate, and defend, and die. All within sometimes even a few seconds if you're a germ. Or if you're a demigod, millions and billions of years. If you're living on Tapaloka, Mahaloka, Janaloka, Brahmaloka, even when there's a devastation of the universe, you're not affected by that. You continue on. Lord Brahma. Yeah. At the end of his one day, that's another mark of time. And then the whole universe, all the activities of the living beings within the universe come to a halt. Yeah, because of the inundation. And then for the 12 hours of Brahma's night, nothing happens. But the very topmost planets, then They're also with Lord Brahma. That's their night time as well. But in the interim period of Brahma's day, then there's also other devastations. Yeah, the Manus. So there's a partial devastation during the appearance of, or at the end of each Manu, and the transfer. There's a sandhya or a junction of time between. There's like a handover period, and there's a partial devastation again. All the activities come to a halt, but only in the lower levels. In the upper levels of the universe, everything is normal. It goes on. So depending on the body, depending on the space that you're occupying, then time has different effect or different meaning for that particular living being. But ultimately, within the whole universe, nobody can escape the effects of time. That means time is supreme. It's another feature of the supreme. Even Lord Brahma is regulated by time. He has a day and he has a night, just as we have a day and a night. Yeah. He can't do anything about that. That's the condition of living in the material world. That means that there's a regulative principle above even Lord Brahma. Because we're talking about here the creation by Lord Brahma, how he, you know, took his birth, his exchange with Lord Vishnu, and then now we'll see how he begins all the work of manifesting the activities of the living beings within the universe, or at least facilitating that, Visarga, not Sarga, but Visarga, secondary. Yeah, it's already decided, the ingredients are there, now he's just kind of throwing it all together, like an engineer. So what is the very first thing that has to be pointed out when you're talking about the life of Lord Brahma? That he's also under the influence of time. Because time is beyond even Lord Brahma. So what to speak about other living beings. So the entire universe is a measurement, if you like, of time. It comes into being and, you know, there's so many things that go on. And then again it's folded up. Then again it comes out. So what is that time factor? That's the point. That's the impersonal energy of the Supreme Absolute Personality of Godhead. Yeah. And Prabhupada, as I mentioned there at the beginning, he takes a nice little dig at the impersonalists who think that they have become liberated, but actually not. Yeah, because they're only interested in this impersonal feature. And the impersonal feature is time. So they can't go beyond time. They're captured in that way. Yeah. Even if they think that they become liberated, again they come back down to the material platform. Because they're still interested in time. So when you're not interested in time anymore, but you're interested in Krishna, then you get free of that regulative influence of this impersonal energy. That means you have to get to the spiritual world. You go back to Vaikuntha Loka or the Goloka Vrindavan planet, then there's no time. But there is still regulation. Krishna's desire and your desire to please Krishna. There's that exchange that's going on. That's the regulative factor in the spiritual world, pure devotional service. So every living being then is regulated by a superior energy or force or personality, depending on how they're situated. So in this material world anyway, at least, Prabhupada's giving a nice example here, that Kala separates the living beings from Krishna personally. Not that they're actually separated, because they're still being regulated by Krishna's energies, but it's something like a tape recorder, where the voice is there but the person's not. So the voice on the tape is an indication of the original person. But you don't see the original person, you only, you know, see some symptom, yeah, some kind of feature of that person. But what is that tape? Yeah. If you break it down into its components, you play the tape, or nowadays, you know, digital. But the same principle is there. You hear the recording, it sounds like the person. It invokes some memory of that person. But when you actually look at the actual instrument, yeah, you don't find anything. If it's a tape, then, you know, there's a, you know, magnetic strip, and there's some kind of means of, you know, agitating the particles on the magnetic strip in such a way that it, you know, it produces a particular pattern, and then you have an instrument which deciphers that pattern and produces this sound. Yeah. But when you look at the whole thing, what's there? What is the substance of it? Nothing. So the material world is just like that. Yeah. By studying the material world, you can actually come to the conclusion that there is a personality behind it. That's the point. But if you look at the substance of the material world, you won't find it. Yeah. If you get on a digital recorder, it's the same principle. You won't find the original person, but you'll get all the, you know, symptoms of his existence. So in the same way then, the study of the material world, we should try to understand what's behind it. You know, it's a separated energy. That's the point that's being made here, that it appears so because of its being separated from the Lord. So that idea of separation, yeah, is very, very important. That somehow or another the Lord in his existence can have a separated existence. Yeah. And that one can exist in that separation, that mood of separation, or that situation of being distant from the Lord. That's the material world. But that doesn't mean that because you're separated that there's not some original thing. So the Mayavadis, they look at this separated energy, or, you know, the material scientists, they're only looking at the separated energy, but they don't, you know, accept that this is symptomatic. Yeah. Which is rather unusual. Why would they not do that? Yeah. Why would they not accept that it's symptomatic? They already admit, actually, you know, in just like this discussion about dark energy and dark matter. You don't know it's there, but you see it by its symptom. They accept that, but they won't accept that the material world as a whole is a symptom of a transcendent spiritual being. So that's, you know, that's really the difficulty. Anyway, that's, you know, the effect of time. Time is that separating factor. Yeah. Not the material energy in itself per se, but time, because time regulates the material energy. It's supreme. Yeah. Even beyond the modes of material nature, it is the regulating factor of the modes of material nature. Therefore, it's superior to even matter itself. Yeah. It's directly the influence of Krishna. Okay, that was a few things about time. Any questions or comments? Come on. Yes. Yeah, it's just the same principle that's going on in the material world. Just like this professor, because you don't see what's gone on in the past, you know, you see something that's going on now, he doesn't like to assume that that means that there is a subtle principle called karma. He can't accept that. Why? Because he's blind. Yeah. He only sees things in terms of one lifetime. This is the difficulty. This is that linear idea. Yeah. And Drudhikarma makes a nice argument that this is what inhibits archaeological studies, anthropological studies. You know, the idea of evolution, it's inadequate and limited. Yeah, because they're blindsided by this idea of linear progression. And as long as they're attached to that idea of a linear progression, they'll never actually understand anything about the material world or the living beings. It blinds them. So the same thing with this professor, because he's got this idea, you know, that there's this, living beings have an origin and they move in a straight line, yeah, from birth to death, and then there's an end situation. That's it. And he can't understand, therefore, why a person, you know, who's suffering in this material world? Why are they suffering? They can't answer that question. That apparently there's no cause for it. A young child, you know, just like yesterday I read in the paper there, not in the paper, on the internet news now, a 9-month-old child had its head chewed off by the family pet dog. Right? Horrible thing. So one can say, well, why did that happen? That baby never did anything. Yeah? And they have no explanation, the Christians. It's a big problem for them. Yeah? But by understanding the cyclic movement of time and the living entities within it, you can understand, yes, that's all. Did something last time, now it's taking, you know, another situation in due course of time, and some result is coming, and then it will move on, you know, into another situation, and it will keep moving like this in cycles, the cycle of birth and death. So it offers a nice explanation about phenomena that we, you know, experience or perceive in this material world. And if you take it on a macrocosmic level, you know, the cycles of yugas, that's another one, and then, you know, the cycles of, you know, the creation and dissolution of the universe. It got, you know, it's there, the understanding is there, but people become blinded. They can't properly understand it. And that example of the scorpion and the eggs is a nice one. Yeah. People think, oh, the scorpion's just popped out from all, you know, the rice. So they think maybe the scorpion's been born from the rice, which is a ridiculous proposition. How can rice give birth to a scorpion? Yeah. But that's because they didn't see what happened before, that the eggs were laid within the rice, and now they've, you know, in due course of time, they've fermented or whatever they do, incubated, and now the living beings come out. So we need the vision of Shastra. We're blinded. We can't see what's going on. We have no real perception. Doesn't matter how hard we try, we'll never understand what this universe is and how it's working. It's so subtle and it's so massive. You cannot grasp it. But you can get an idea, at least, from an authoritative source. So the best source, of course, is Lord Brahma. Because he saw everything at the very beginning and he knows that, you know, how everything is working. Yes. Sorry, you have to speak up.
I want to know whether the view of time is it a circle or is it a spiral?
It's neither. It's Krishna. That's the whole point. You can't measure time. What you're trying to describe is the effect of time. Yeah. Is it a circle or is it a spiral? But either way, it's moving. A spiral is a stretched out circle. It's a circle in 3D. Right? You take a circle and you stretch it like that. Same thing. Yeah. The point is that living beings don't have a point of origin, and therefore they have no end either. They're eternal. So in the material world, because you're entrapped in a space, you're in a circle or a spiral. You're just going around and around and around. You're not really getting anywhere. That's the problem. Yeah. If you get out of the material universe, then you're in the unlimited spiritual world. And then activities flow, but there's no past and there's no future. That's a really difficult concept. If there's no past and there's no future, then how can you have movement? But there is movement. But that movement is eternal. There's no... Because in the material world, movement is measured by deterioration. Change. Right? Things, they have a certain form at one point, and then they change, and that's how you measure it. By the change. So we, you know, a body comes about, and then by its change, you measure the movement of the living being that's within that body. And then when the final change comes, the atoms disassemble. Now, we don't see that living being where he moves to next, but he has moved. So we, you know, our conception of movement is tends to be limited by the material objects that we occupy. So we like to measure things. This is our disease. Yeah? We try to measure things. But everything is immeasurable. You can't measure anything. You can't even measure an atom. Yeah. And you can't measure this material universe. And you certainly can't measure the spiritual universe. You can't measure a soul. It's very, very difficult. So, you know, we have this disease of measuring from the past to the future and everything in between. We want to see that and identify it and label it, you know. But what we're seeing is not what is really there. What we see, it's not really there. That's the problem. So whether you want to say a spiral or a circle or whatever, but in the material universe, we're just stuck. That's all. We're not going anywhere. We think we're doing so many things and moving here and there, but we're not going anywhere. In the spiritual world, everybody's going everywhere and nowhere. There's no past, there's no future, there's only the present. There's just, you know, interaction with Krishna. And that's eternal. There's no deterioration to mark it. Yeah? Even though Krishna has childhood activities, you know, he has his different ages, you know, Bala and Kishore and like this. But still, Krishna is the same supreme eternal personality. He doesn't change. Even though he apparently has a childhood, or he has childhood pastimes, you know, and then he has his next pastimes, you know, that are as a youth. But it's the same Krishna. So, you can't measure time. And you can't describe it, you know, in three dimensions or ten dimensions or you know, or one dimension. It's not dimensional. That's the point. If that's confused you, that's good. Yes, Philip. That's the whole point that I'm making. Yeah. Krishna has his pastimes, but they're not regulated in the way that our activities are regulated by time. Krishna doesn't have to go to sleep at night. There doesn't even have to be a night. There actually isn't a night, but sometimes it appears that way to facilitate more pastimes. Because in the nighttime, so-called nighttime in the spiritual world in Vrindavan, Krishna's out enjoying with the gopis. Mother Jasoda thinks he's asleep, but he's out in the forest enjoying. So for some living beings, they think there's a day and a night because that's the way that their leelas work. Yeah? They want to relate to Krishna in certain ways, so we facilitate that by Yogamaya creating certain conditions which apparently look like day or night, but they're not. And in one sense it's described that way because that's the only way that we can appreciate it, because that's our experience. But if you're in the spiritual world, it's nothing like the passing of day and night that we experience in the material world. So it's a comparative, but it's not really, you know, it doesn't explain everything. If you say that Krishna has all these different activities at different times of the day, you know, what is his day? Is it 24 hours? Has he got a clock up on the wall? You know, no. He's just flowing from what, you know. Well, it's not even that he's flowing from one activity to another. All the activities are flowing, but they're not going from one to another in that sense. They're all going on simultaneously. So you can't figure that, because we think that night comes after day. Yeah, you do some activities during the day, and then at night you do something else. But that's not what goes on in the spiritual world. These are all just moods, day and night. The moon coming up, the sun being there. Yeah. What is the sun in the spiritual world? Or the moon? Yeah. These are all just, the transcendental situations that Krishna or Yogamaya, manifests for the pleasure of Krishna and his devotees. That's all. They're leelas, rasa, sweetness. That's all it is. But to talk about Krishna's day and night, immediately we try to frame Krishna's activities in the same way that we framed our activities. And you really can't do that. It's inconceivable. That's why we say everything, not just beta tattva, simultaneously one and different. It's achintya beta tattva. It is completely inconceivable. You simply experience it. You never understand it. Morari. It is by experience. Morari is asking that if a person doesn't know why he's being punished, then what's the effect of it? I mean, does it actually have, a reformatory effect? Because if you don't know what you've done, and then you're getting punished, you'll resent it. Most people do that, what was that for? What did I do? Like that. So the idea is that Shastra Chakshu, through the eye of Shastra, you can understand that you've done something in the past. Yeah. So when you get to that point, then you learn something. But even if you don't get to that point, there's still the experience of being reformed. Yeah. Just like if you put your hand in the fire, you don't need to have somebody sit down and explain the physics of it. Right? That your hand's made of this kind of material and the fire's made of this, and when they combine together, this one, gets altered in this way, and then, there's these electrical impulses that run up your arm and into your brain, and they tell you that, you're being hurt, and then you pull it out. You don't need to do that. You put your hand in the fire, you get burnt, you don't do it again. You learn by experience. So the idea is that even if you don't understand what you've done in the past, whatever your experience is right now, it tends to, start regulating what you're going to do and what you don't do. But over periods of many lifetimes. Yeah? So there's a gradual reformation of the soul through, this evolution of this species. Yeah, so gradually, the soul is given more conscious awareness of himself as he comes up through the species. He's learning. When he gets to the human form, then he can actually inquire. So there's been a reformation of that, sinful living being all the way through. Otherwise, he could not have come to the point of making an inquiry in the human form. But that is a kind of reformation that's, in one sense, it's given to him. It's not by his own choice. It's the mercy of Krishna to get him out of the material world. But he doesn't leave the soul stuck in the material world forever. But he gives him an opportunity. He gives him a chance. So when he gets the reactions to his activities, which he deserves, and the activity in the material world is really, it's just one living being encroaching on the rights of another living being. And that's why there's punishment, because as soon as you encroach on somebody else's territory, you're guilty. As soon as you do something against another living being to his detriment, you're guilty. You get some punishment. And that's all that's going on in the material world. It's one living being encroaching on another living being, and therefore they have to be punished or, restricted in what they do, and they get a reaction for that. But it doesn't end there. Krishna very kindly lets that living being gradually come you know, back up to a point where he can make his own choices again. So he comes up, you know, through the different species, and then he gets this human form, and then hopefully he'll take advantage, you know, of a real reformatory system, an accelerated reformatory system, if you like, which is, you know, hearing from liberated souls, reading Shastra, you know, coming in contact with elevated personalities who have the vision and do know what's going on in the material world, and then can tell you, now, you know, you're suffering, or you've got this position because of all the things that you've done in the past, and you do have a past. You're not that body, you're a soul, and so you've got this culmination of, you know, results from your previous activities. That's why you're suffering now. Now, here's how to solve that. Here's how to get out of that. So you have that choice then in the human form. So Krishna makes this very nice arrangement. So karma is a very perfect tool for reforming the living being. It's not blind. That professor, he was thinking it's just blindness. But even then, his argument is very weak. You know, if somebody goes out, let's say he's a burglar, and this happens sometimes. You get these characters, they go out and they're professional thieves. So they burgle hundreds, sometimes even thousands of homes. They do so many burglaries, they forget what they've done. Yeah, it's just like one after another. They just forget it. But when they get caught, you know, does it mean that now because they can't remember all the people that they stole from in the past, that they shouldn't get punished for that? No, the person that was being, that had the stuff stolen, he doesn't forget. Yeah, he remembers. Yeah, so the thief should be punished even if he doesn't remember everything that he's done. So in a similar way, the living entity has actually done things against other living beings. Therefore, he deserves his punishment, even if he can't remember it. Yeah? Some people do so many things against so many living beings, even they can't calculate what they've done. Hitler, you know, or Napoleon. Napoleon, he fought 64 wars in 20 years. That was his... You know, that was his mode. He was a general. He was I wouldn't say he's a chatrier. But, you know, he was in that warrior mode. He had 64 wars in 20 years. 2 million troops died just because he liked to fight. Yeah? So he's got that, you know, the weight of that responsibility of the deaths of so many innocent young men. Well, not necessarily innocent, but... You know, he has that upon his head. So sometimes, you know, living beings, when they start some activity in motion, even they can't calculate, you know, the effects that are going to come from that. Things have a tendency to just get out of hand, but they're still responsible. You know, just because they lose control of the situation doesn't mean that they're not responsible. They started it, or they made the decision. So then how much karma does he have? You know, 2 million people's lives. He's got to pay for that. He's the one that put them in that situation. So we may not understand what's going on. We may not appreciate necessarily everything that we do and the effects that it has. But there are living beings in the material world that know exactly everything. They know exactly everything. And when the right time comes, you get the result. But it's not without some compassion. And Krishna therefore arranges, all right, at a certain point you can come back up and remember, you know, become aware of yourself again. And take responsibility for your actions and rectify. That's all. Up to the highest point. So it's a very, very nice system. But the professor was totally wrong, you know, in his idea of what karma is. It means he didn't really understand the process because he was trapped in this linear idea of time, that there's a starting point of the living being, and then he has a certain period of time, and then at the end there's a big judgment, Everything comes to a stop, and then there's a judgment, and then you either go to heaven or hell. So because he's blinded by that concept, he can't then understand, you know, another explanation of the situation of the living beings in material nature. All right, we'd better finish there. It's getting late. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.